And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
Mitch Evans and Jaguar Racing roar back into title contention with double wins. Robin Frines bags two podiums for Envision Racing, and Oliver Turvey and Dan Ticktum score rare points for Neo 333. All these stories and more coming up in the Race Formula E podcast from the Rome E-Prix. Hello, I'm Andrew Vandenberg, and joining me as usual to pick over the events from the Eternal City is the Race Formula E writer Sam Smith. After 4 days in Italy, we look like a pair of pizzas, but a much healthier presence, I'm sure, is our guest, Jim Wright, who joins us to review the races and dip into several other key topics in the world of Formula E. Jim is a familiar face in the paddock after holding key commercial roles at Venturi, Mahindra, and now with the Avalanche Andretti squad, where he is the group commercial director. He's also been the secretary of the Formula E Teams and Manufacturers Association since its inception. Prior to that, Jim had lengthy spells at Williams, Toro Rosso and Virgin F1 teams from 1994 to 2012. And he's also written the odd column for The Race about commercial stuff. So, Jim, welcome to the show. Great to have you here today.
Thank you. Pleasure to be on, and looking forward to going through the events of Rome.
So, Sam, let's start in time-honoured fashion by trying to embarrass our guests. So, how do you get on with Jim?
Oh, well, very well, apart from Watford's home form, which is Jim's football team, which occasionally tests his patience, I think. But no, seriously, I think, yeah, Jim's a very respected, enormously respected individual in motorsport with great experience. And he clearly loves the sport as well, which also helps. Always very interesting, very erudite on commercial topics and sporting topics. So, yeah, he's somebody I think's a major asset for particularly for TAMA, the Formula E Teams and Manufacturers Association, that he's been the secretary at for, I think, since the inception, pretty much. So, yeah, someone who, like I say, is imbued in racing and has been for probably 40 odd years now, Jim. Sorry if that makes you feel a bit old, but it's probably around about that time in various positions. So he tends to see the bigger picture stuff in sporting and commercial tone. So yeah, it's always a pleasure to chat to Jim. So we're fortunate today.
So Jim, Sam and I were actually both in Rome, but you weren't. So you're in a better position to say what it looked like from the TV. Was it as entertaining from the sofa as it was from trackside?
Yes, it was. I mean, the Rome track is just fabulous, isn't it? It's everything that Formula E is about. It's those, the backdrop of those Mussolini buildings with the futuristic Formula E intertwining, going through and around those buildings. And then you've got that circuit change, the elevation changes. I think it's 80 metres from the top of the hill to the bottom. And you've got the different surfaces. Yeah, it's everything, isn't it, that Formula E is about. And the racing didn't disappoint. And I think before the start of a race, was it Vernon and Daria were asked, pick a winner, and they said, not a chance. You know, you could give me 10 names and any one of them could win. And that's great. That's great motor racing.
Yeah, I saw Mitch Evans on the grid where he was obviously quite disappointed to line up ninth, but was looking, you know, pretty confident. But there aren't many places and many championships, Sam, where you get drivers coming through the field in the way that he did. How did that drive rank among those top FE drives that we've seen of the past?
Top draw, absolutely top draw. And I think I just got the impression that even Mitch was slightly surprised how efficiently and how quickly he was able to do it. Jags came away from Mexico City in a real trough, and they knuckled down with some deep dive debriefs after that event. They were led down blind alleys themselves. You know, I think Mitch was part of the blame for that as well, and acknowledged that. And as a team, they sort of galvanized what they had. I don't think there was any dispute that they always had a quick package, but I think a combination of polishing the qualifying protocols and getting that leaked. And I mean, ironically, they didn't do that on Saturday, did they? They left Mitch out too long and he overcooked his tyres and he ended up in that ninth position. But I think it even surprised them how quickly they were able to cut through the pack with really strong energy management and just inherent pace. I mean, the Jaguar has always been very strong on 90-degree corners and traction out of slow corners and hairpins. I mean, the Marconi hairpin isn't especially a tight hairpin, but still, you need a good thrust out of that. And I think Jaguars, the way the systems work with also the mechanical diff that the cars use is very good. It's very strong. So they've used that, they've harnessed it, and they've got the result. But, you know, they did it incredibly well. I think from a human point of view, Mitch spent some time back in New Zealand, which I think is really important. I think everyone has roots, and he wasn't able to go back and see his family for 2 years, two and a bit years since the pandemic began. So, you know, that was a nice sort of human story that he was able to do that and refresh himself and get back into the groove. And boy, didn't he do it. I mean, a remarkable set of results, a very rare thing, getting a double over a former weekend, especially, you know, especially as from a performance perspective, you know, we've seen things like Buemi in season two dominate before to that level, but that of course was when there was a bigger variation in the powertrain tech and the capability, whereas now in the final year of a rule set that we have in Gen 3, so much harder. You know, it's really concertina to the pack. I mean, all bar two teams really are within, certainly on pace, one lap pace within 5 or 6 tenths tops at a long track like Rome. So to do what Jad did, very impressive indeed when there's a mature rule set. So, yeah, they deserve all the plaudits they got and all the points they bagged this weekend.
Yeah, the big cat had rather blunt claws at the start of the season, Jim. So was it a surprise to see them turning around like this, or was that latent potential always there?
No, I don't think it was a surprise. As Sam said, I think, you know, they were one of the favourites at the beginning of the year. I do think that sometimes they overcomplicate things, and we saw again in Rome in one of the sessions where they left it so late to go across the line, and because Buemi wasn't going at the speed that Sam Bird needed him to go at, Sam got very irate. And I think if there's a criticism of that team, and who am I to criticise, but if there was, it would be, did they overcomplicate things? Do they push things more to the limit than they should do? And it's not the first time that they've been caught out in terms of a car not crossing the start line before the checkered flag comes down for the end of a session. But no, it wasn't a surprise. And two very good, strong drivers, not only quick, but racers, can overtake cleanly, efficiently. And, you know, the car is obviously working very, very well. The team's been coming together for 2 or 3 years. And you're seeing the fruits of that now. So not a surprise, but it shows how small the margins are, because, you know, if you look at Mercedes, we came away from Riyadh all scratching our heads saying, wow, how can we get near Mercedes? They looked ordinary this weekend, still competitive, but nothing special. So things can change very, very quickly in Formula E.
Yeah, Sam, I think Jim alluded to it there. What was incredibly impressive about Mitch's performance was the cleanliness of those overtakes, because we saw quite a few instances where things got a bit mucky, bits of cars ended up flying off, which is just part and parcel of Formula E racing. But the way that he controlled and executed those races was highly impressive. Is he a genuine title challenger now?
Yeah, and I think he always was. I think even though he'd accrued only 1 point from those first three races, it looked extremely bad on paper, but I think they've always had the capacity to get big points quickly, and so it proved at the weekend. The overtaking was clinical and it was decisive. I think the days of seeing that kind of tactical contact, let's call it, they're not eradicated completely. I think that'll always be part of some drivers' makeup. But what I'm noticing at the top of the field, at the sharp end, which has naturally come to the fore, and maybe we'll go on to this a bit later in terms of the qualifying format change, I think what that brings is a cleaner a cleaner focus for the drivers at the front, because they don't have those pesky dragons or whatever that are out of position on the grid. You know, they can form a racing strategy much easier than they used to do in the old qualifying format. And I think that brings a purity to the racing. And when you look at the top three in the championship, which is Jean-Éric Vergne, Robin Freins and Stoffel Vandoorne, they're yet to win a race, but they're getting consistent points. Now, it's a real cliche to say, isn't it? You know, you've got to have consistent point scoring. Of course you do. For any championship campaign, you have to have that. But last year, you know, it was very much, it wasn't part of the makeup and the feature of winning a championship. Now it is. And I think that is in the forefront of drivers and their engineers and strategists' minds, not to get involved in first lap scrapes as much. I mean, we will still see them, but I think more further down the midfield and the rear of the grid. I think those days of seeing Vandoorne and Lotterer last season at Turn 7 at Rome, scrapping for a line, are largely a thing of yesteryear. And I think that's good for the long-term evolution of races.
In terms of results, it wasn't such a great weekend for Sam Bird in the second Jaguar, although he did play a role in ensuring Mitch got the result he needed. But his race on Sunday ended with a shunt, and he's got a three-place penalty for Monaco. Can you explain what happened, Sam, and is it a justified penalty?
Well, yes, it was a justified penalty, and it was ultimately such a shame for Sam and for Jaguar, but most importantly for Nick Cassidy, who'd also driven a great race and come through and was the innocent, or the mostly the innocent party in that. Sam Bird drove very well all weekend and probably deserved a bigger points haul than he got in the end. But at Turn 7, he just tagged Cassidy, tried to get out of it. But just there is so little room on the exit of that corner that Nick just hit the tire walls fairly gently, and his, you know, his race was effectively done, and Sam retired because of it. You know, as far as I understand, Sam apologised to Cassidy. It was a bit of a slam dunk penalty, really. Problem for him is that it comes at Monaco. A three-place grid drop isn't a complete disaster, especially if Jaguar would show the pace that they did in Rome. But it is a much more difficult place to overtake, although Formula E showed, obviously, that with the sporting format they have, and in particular the attack mode, that you can overtake in places where F1 and other formulas can't. So, yeah, and Sam played a really significant part in Mitch's win on Sunday. I mean, he was able to to flick a match into Jev's brain and make it burn even further, as we saw. Jev had various degrees of rants during his race, and Sam added to that and rattled him a little further. So he did that just by holding him up for a couple of laps, allowing Mitch to make a bit of a break for it before that penultimate safety car, and it all really contributed to the win. So a nice team job by Bird, and again, you know, those two work in really, really good harmony, and it's paying dividends for the team as a whole.
Jim, Sam mentioned earlier that he feels that the way the new qualifying format has gone is rewarding consistency more. It certainly made it a much easier narrative about where the pace is at the front. From a team perspective, have you changed the way that you operate? Does it mean that you approach races strategically in a different way now?
There are some changes. Before I answer that, can I just go back to a point Sam was making on the penalties? It's quite interesting because you've got the stewards have at their want an array of penalties which they can apply, and they don't like to say it's X penalty for Y offence, and we understand that. But it's quite interesting because, you know, the penalty which Sam gets for Monaco, it raises the question, is that sufficient? At the end of the day, Nick Cassidy was taken out of a race through no fault of his own and had points, lost points. Lucas Degrassi on Jake Dennis, very similar. And you question whether a 5-second penalty or 3-place grid drop or whatever, is that sufficient for taking someone out of a race? I'm throwing it out there. I think when I look at it, I think Is that enough? Is it enough of a deterrent?
That's an interesting question.
Yeah. No, I mean, what else can you do? I mean, if, you know, in that instance, both drivers' races were ruined. You know, in addition to that, Sam got penalty points on his license. And look, I know that's a separate topic. And I think many of us look at the penalty points and see them as pretty useless. I mean, last season, Andre Lotterer got us...
Well, no one's ever actually got to the maximum amount, have they?
Well, you know, by rights, some of Lotterer's antics last year, you know, he should have sat out an entire season if it was taken to his logical conclusion.
But let me pick up on your point, Sam. You said that the penalty Sam gets is transferred to Monaco, but it shouldn't be that much of an issue given how quick the car is. That's the point. It's not that much of a punishment.
Yeah.
And Nick Cassidy will look at that and think, well, you know what? You know, I had points taken away and I needed that. I needed that for my confidence. I needed that for my team.
Mm.
And I'm not having to go at Sam Bird at all. This applies to everyone. Lucas probably has hit more cars than anyone else in the history of Formula E. And that's his style. And he gets away with it quite a bit. Sometimes he doesn't get away with it. But to go back to your earlier point, but the driving appears to be cleaner now because the qualifying system is fair. It's more of a meritocracy. My question is, do we need to look again at those penalties? Because I'm not sure that the punishment is always fitting the crime.
So do you feel that the penalty ought to represent what the driver who's been who's been impacted against has lost? So if you take someone out when you're battling for 14th, it's not severe as if you take someone out when you're battling for a podium, for example. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, and you know, Sam's penalty is didn't apply in Rome. It's now applying in Monaco. Do we need to do that? Could he not just have his 30 seconds or whatever penalty is going to be taken off his Rome race time?
But then there's no real, yeah. I mean, you know, he ultimately retired from that incident, didn't he? So, I mean, I just wonder if it's ever been discussed, and maybe Jim, you know, and you're always for time, I don't know, but the attack mode for the following race. You know, we're talking about a following race and a following an event, and I understand that. But some incidents, it's almost impossible to dock sufficiently the perpetrator, isn't it? If you've both retired, for instance. I just wonder if it, with the attack mode and the time of that, has it ever been discussed or could it be discussed to dock that a little as well?
No, it hasn't. I would say for the first 5-6 years of Formula E, it was consistently a point on our end of season review meetings to analyze penalties and were the penalties given a fair? Were they, did you get a repeat of the same penalty for similar offenses? You know, I'm thinking back, Sam, to when the pit stops in Generation 1.
Mm-hmm.
We had very different penalties given out for infringements there, you know.
Oh, we had the seatbelts that time in Chile and stuff.
Yes, an unsafe release and that kind of stuff. So it's always been a point we review these things. We're always told the FIA are continually reviewing it. It's really not your business. You carry on racing. Let us do the rules. And we agree with that to a certain extent. But I think we are in a good position to say, look, here's the question. Is this fair? Is this working? Should we be reviewing it? And, you know, as you said, I was watching from my armchair and I just would question sometimes now if we're getting the penalties right to fit the offences. That would be my point.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So, Andrew, let me go back then qualifying, and these things are kind of linked. I think the qualifying system is now fairer. It's more of a meritocracy. I personally liked the qualifying, I think it was season 4, where we had the championship protagonists all in the same group, but they could be drawn in either groups 1, 2, 3, or 4. So you still had that little bit of randomness about it, but it was much fairer. That was my favourite. The present system is growing on me. I quite like. I think the way they're showing the two laps side by side on the television is very, very good. They've got the graphics right there, and hats off to Formula E TV for doing that.
Oh, they did a good job of that this weekend, for sure.
Yeah, they did. Very, very good. But it is quite long now, and I'm not sure that a casual viewer or a one of our teenagers with low attention spans is necessarily going to be hooked on that for that length of time.
Those knockout stages do go on for quite a while, don't they?
I think so. And the other thing I would question is, at the end there, Jake Dennis had done that unbelievable lap. We talk about Jake being a latter-day Nigel Mansell. That was a Mansell-esque lap in his semi to beat Mitch. And then there wasn't a lot of time for him to gather his thoughts, calm himself down from that, do whatever they're allowed to do on the car, which isn't a lot, and go out again. So, I question, whether Jeff, who, obviously would have had at least another 5-7 minutes, had a little bit of an advantage there.
Yeah, his tyres have cooled a little bit and all of that, haven't they?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's the key point, is the tyres. But it's difficult to get away around that unless you even extend it further, by which time everyone's lost interest and is just looking forward to the race, aren't they, from a spectator point of view. I think for me, I think something that can be addressed is that in that gap, that more can be done. I think, getting the two team principals together in this new nice shiny studio and doing a bit of low-level trash talk or whatever, or you could even make it amusing from that extent. I think getting the two team principals to kind of, try and out-psych each other is something that they should explore, because you want to see that. You can't do that with the drivers because they're in the cockpit and getting ready. Or potentially you could. Why can't Dario and Jack speak to the drivers in that 5-minute gap, because they do it at the end of the race? So why not?
Well, here's an idea for you guys. Have you guys watched Extreme E?
Not all of them, I've got to be honest. I haven't watched them all.
Okay, so you will see, there's a command center there where as the cars go out for qualifying or for the race or whatever, it focuses in on the team principals and exactly the kind of scenario you've described, Sam. And I'm wondering if the team principals could be moved to that studio and create a sort of command center in the middle of a pit lane there, where you've got Dario thrusting a microphone underneath their noses. That might make for a bit of good theater, actually.
There was a lot of, hand-wringing probably is the wrong term, but people trying to work out how Formula E can benefit from the amazing way that Drive to Survive has brought new fans into Formula One. But I think the essence of what Drive to Survive has done is created characters. And when you've got characters and character arcs, people want to engage. And in order to have that, you need to have tension, and you need to have heroes and villains and good guys and bad guys. And the more exposure there is on that and the more tension, so long as it's not too artificial that you create in that, the easier it is to sell that narrative. And they have these little videos that come up and people talk about stuff, but they're all far too nice.
Yeah.
You need to have a few more bastards in there, quite frankly.
Well, I wouldn't describe Nick De Vries as that, but after Saturday's race, it generally wasn't known, but Nick was pretty unpopular with several drivers, the DS to Cheetah guy certainly, and Pascal Wehrlein, for which he got a result for that contact. And having a spotter in the TV studios, which I know that they've used before and probably still do to some extent, to understand and know that, and then to exploit it in a, like you say, VDB, not in a completely...
It can't be too manufactured, because it doesn't mean anything.
No. But it's there, isn't it? You've got drivers that are pissed off with another driver. Well, have a little dig. See what you can get. I mean, that's what we do in the media pen, and that's half an hour after the end of the race. If you do it straight... straight off, you're going to get something, aren't you? When emotions and the adrenaline's pumping. So yeah, I think that certainly to be used in the context of this studio in the pit lane, you know, that should be. I'm sure that's part and parcel of their debriefs. The Aurora and the TV production are looking at that, but that certainly would be a great deal of fun, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And to the point now, we're hearing that Netflix are organising for team principals to be doing tours of the circuit in Formula One. So to your point, Andrew, it has brought those team principals forward, front and centre. And, you know, we've got some great characters there. You know, Dealbag would be a great character to have in that situation. If he could get his cars up the sharp end, and yeah, it could be very entertaining.
Well, that sort of segues nicely, Sam, into the next bit, which is a Jean-Éric Vergne story and some very interesting language that you use on team radio. So how did he exactly burn his brain?
Well, you know, Vergne's the gift that keeps on giving, isn't it, when it comes to animated radio banter and making his point across, giving a running commentary almost of how things are going in the cockpit, which, you know, when it's going well, you don't tend to hear that much until the end of the race. But when it's not going well, boy, do we all know about it. And Rome was a real case in point where it must have, well, it was a must listen. And whoever made the radio so accessible for Formula E and the way that they do that for us all, you know, frankly, should be knighted, I think. It was a great thing to do. The confusion really stemmed from such a complex and flexible energy strategy that pretty much everybody was employing over the course of the race, essentially how long the race was going to be, whether it was going to be 27 or 28 laps. Because we've got this timed format now, 45 minutes plus one lap. But of course, the teams have to strategize the energy management, you know, where they're going to regen, and all these things are in this great big soup of a strategy. And then something like race suspensions are thrust into it, and then extra time is, and then you've got to do these calculations on the hoof, and that really does test teams. You know, that is something that they practice and strategize during these exhaustive simulation runs, but actually doing it on the day is, you know, does have its own nuances. It was happening really thick and fast. It was, of course, happening for the entire field, but if you're cute, you know to go to Jev's radio, because you are going to get a lot of vocal and interesting comments between he and his engineer. And so it was, and so it proved. And there was just a really great part of it where he was so confused about what he was being asked to do for the strategy and the cryptos that were being asked of him and how the race was going to pan out, that at one stage he said, "Man, this is burning my brain. It's really burning my, you know, expletive brain." And I just thought that was brilliant and so funny the way that it was articulated. At the same time, I really felt for his engineer, Thibaut Arnau, and also tech boss Leo Thomas, who's pulling the strings as well from a strategy point of view. Those guys deserved and earned some serious beers on Sunday night because the stress of juggling all that with Jev in your ear and so animated was colossal. And, you know, it's very much of the moment. It's the adrenaline's going and they're trying to, Jev is trying to be, Jev is racing wheel to wheel at 140 miles an hour, whatever, with those in and around him, and it's so close. But I spoke to Jev afterwards, and you know, he'd calmed significantly, was leading the championship, but he was still, you know, he was still kind of confused about what had panned out during that race. So that's where it all came from, and God bless Jean-Éric Vergne, because he just keeps giving us great stories and that reactionary stuff that we just talked about. You know, it's happening there and it's live, and we get to listen to it as it happens. It's terrific.
But Andrew and Sam, this is a part I really enjoy about Formula E, and I think this is something which perhaps we don't talk loudly enough about. These guys are racing in very difficult cars to drive on street circuits, very difficult conditions. They're always in a fight. You never really have someone cruising. Mitch Evans' last couple of laps may be the exception, but you know what I mean? They're always racing. And yet, they're getting all this complex instruction through their ears. If it's not beeps its engineers. To do all of that whilst maintaining concentration racing around circuits like Rome is quite phenomenal, in my opinion. And really, that's justifies the salaries these guys get. It's incredible to see and understand.
Oh, I don't know, and they do it. I think with all those things going on, I would definitely forget where my breaking point was and shove it into the barrier. I can't believe that doesn't happen more often, frankly.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah.
Jim, there were a couple of subpar performances, not least from the past two champions, Nyck de Vries and Antonio Felix da Costa. Are you surprised at their struggles at the minute?
Well, it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because all through the championship now, you're seeing struggles going on between drivers. And, you know, I know Sam regularly writes about market value of drivers and silly season. And, you know, if you were making your driver decisions now, you might have a different viewpoint from what you'd had before the season started. But it'll probably change again by the time, you know, we've had another two or three races. But at the moment, you'd have to say Jev is well on top of Antonio Felix da Costa, which is a little bit of a surprise. And again, Van Dorn seems to be well on top of de Vries. So yes, there are some surprises going on. We've spoke about Evans seemingly having the upper hand over Bird. Yeah, there's some interesting stuff going on. Lotterer blowing away Verlaine at the moment.
Yeah.
So
I don't think many of us saw that one coming.
No. So very interesting stuff. And obviously it goes to driver market values. And you know, Sam will know better than me whose contracts are up, whose aren't. And you know, the other point about that driver contracts is, you know, teams will tell you we've got X under contract, but X may also have some conditionality in that contract, obviously, which says that if he's not in an agreed position in the table by such and such a date, then he's free to leave. So it's often a lot more complex than it will seem on the surface.
It's interesting those two drivers mentioned there, de Vries and da Costa, because both of them are in situations presently where, well, certainly da Costa, my feeling is that, you know, his future will be at Porsche, and the rumours at the weekend that deal is done. We don't know that yet, and I don't expect that to be confirmed until much later this year. But the feeling is that da Costa will be a Porsche driver next season. With de Vries is on the face of it quite complex, because the team is, Mercedes is going to go away from Formula E. That team is expected to carry on. We've heard the rumours that things are close with McLaren, with Saudi commercial partnership there. We expect that to be announced in the coming weeks, if not sooner. But de Vries, of course, no one's talking about his option or his expected promotion to Toyota Gazoo Racing in the FIA World Endurance Championship. Now, if that's the case, can he do both championships? You know, we could face at least a one-time champion, essentially a double champion, of course, if he wins again this year, not racing in Formula E next season, because there are certain exclusivities with Toyota, which we know exist, because Sebastian Buemi has to take priority to Le Mans and Sebring, at least, potentially another race in his contract. So, yeah, it's super interesting. And, yeah, I'm not saying that contributed to poor performances this weekend at all, but certainly it gives another indication that there's a lot going on in drivers, apart from what they're doing in the cockpit. There's a lot going on away from the track also.
Yeah, there's another.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
A driver which is a driver pairing which is surprising me a little bit, and Ido Mortara seems really well on top of Degrassi, and you know, he's been at the team longer than Lucas, so that may take a little bit of bedding in. But Lucas has a high price tag attached to his driving contracts. He's touted around, obviously, by his management team highly. he's got to deliver in the second part of a season, because otherwise I can see his value going down considerably and his options narrowing.
Yeah. Well, another driver whose contract expires at the end of the season is Oliver Turvey, and he was part of the feel-good story of the weekend, arguably, when him and Dan Ticktum got Neo 333 into its first double points finish since Buenos Aires 2017. Is that right, Sam? Surely it can't be that long ago. I was still working in the championship then.
Yes, 5 years ago. Extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah, Nelson Piquet and Turvey finished in the top 10, and that hasn't happened since that time. So a real barren period for the team. We know that it's been through this restructure, or probably several restructures in reality, since 2019 time. And that's continuing. They've got new headquarters. They're building for the future. They've got some stability in ownership. They use a network of suppliers, including Integral Powertrain, which is a really strong tech company that deliver great hardware. I think Neo there are two teams that have in the last few years been in that sort of wooden spoon bracket, aren't there? There are Dragon Penske and Neo 333. I think from the outside it looks at the moment that Neo is in a healthier place. We have written that we believe that Dragon Penske will partner with DS for next season, which, if accurate, which we think it is that will become a much healthier and more productive and performance orientated proposition. Neo, I think what they've shown is that they can improve incrementally, even in the last season of a Gen 2 rule set. And I think what we saw last season evidenced that. Yes, there was some luck. Yes, they had this real gamble of a strategy. I mean, Oliver Turvey essentially freewheeled the first of those 27 laps on Sunday and banked a load of energy, which contributed to this remarkable result of seventh place. And good on them. You know, they took a huge gamble. They tried it in Mexico and it didn't come off, and it did. But, you know, they have limited options. They haven't got the quickest package on the grid, so they have to be creative, and it paid off for them. And Turvey is the kind of guy who can absolutely deliver. Dan Ticktum is another, I think, under the radar success story this season. I think he's been exceptional for a rookie, you know, in his first five races to deliver. Okay, he's not delivered results, but, you know, he hasn't put it in the barriers on multiple occasions, which many rookies have done. He's obviously a feisty character, which is absolutely fine. He doesn't have many filters, but he is—he's delivering, and he is—you know—he's putting some pressure on Oliver. And I think when you get that with a rookie, it pushes the experienced old hand to new heights as well. So I think they've got a really nice setup there. I'm expecting them to get more points this season, and as we saw in free practice three, when Dan Ticktum was fourth, pretty much on merit. I mean, you know, it wasn't as if it was a, you know, there was an anomaly. That lap he did was pretty much on merit, and he was disappointed not to get a sniff of the duels in the afternoon because he had a brake split issue on his Neo 333. Then, yeah, things are looking pretty good for Neo. I think they can surprise on a few other occasions this season.
Jim, when you have a run like Neo have had where points have been so hard to come by, how much of a boost is a result like that to team morale and, you know, how you can kick on and repeat that sort of thing?
Huge, Andrew. You can't underestimate it. You know, the guys that work in the Neo garage are doing the same hours, if not more, than the guys in the Mercedes garage, you know, winning on a regular basis. And morale, you know, does suffer. There's no doubt about it. If every week, you know, you're not getting a result. So to get some kind of result and, you know, a double points finish will be a massive lift for them. There'll be a spring in the step, and they'll go to Monaco in a very, very different frame of mind. So it's a huge boost. Never underestimate what a boost that is. And, you know, Oliver Turvey as well. He's had some really, really lean years. He's talented. We know that. And Dan Ticktum, clearly not short of confidence. He's going to be, as Sam alludes to, He could be a major player in Formula E in coming years. So really good to see them taking a few steps forward. And no one in the paddock will begrudge that for them. They're good guys.
Sam, one of the performances that, well, didn't go under the radar because you made mention of it, and I saw Jack did as well, but unrewarded, Sete Câmara was a bit of a star for Dragon Penske this weekend as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. He deserves a mention to Sergio because he was on it. He's always on it, and he can always drag times out of the Penske EV5. But he's always on the edge as well, and we saw that in qualifying, didn't we, on Sunday when he managed to get it on the cusp of the duels and then went for it again and could have possibly scraped into the duels, but locked up and hit the wall. Thankfully, didn't do too much damage. But extremely difficult for those guys this season with that package. I think their prospects are probably lower than Neo's, which is going to be a real a test of their morale for the season. But I think with this news that their future, certainly the manufacturer partnership that they will have for the first time, because they've previously always been a manufacturer themselves, but I think many have wondered why the management there, Jay Penske and Nicolas Medoui, have not looked at this before. But eventually they have. I think a lot of things will be addressed. And I think that could be a decent proposition for the future. But whether or not Sergio Sete Câmara will be a part of that, I'm not sure. I did sort of tentatively ask him at the weekend, and things are still being worked on there. He's part of the Julian and Alexander Jacoby stable of drivers, of which there are many in Formula E. So I think he's in a reasonable position to get a drive, but I'm just not sure that it'll be with that team. But let's see. Hopefully it can be. But he's one of those drivers that can excavate times from equipment that you don't think is possible, and is great to watch as well. You know, he's a super reflexy driver, so always a bit of a crowd pleaser. And of course, at the minute, Antonio Giovinazzi, who had another pretty wretched weekend on home soil, you know, I think that it's a huge test of Giovinazzi's motivation and willing to be part of Formula E for the future, that really, again, he's got the same difficulties and the same challenges as Sete Câmara, but Giovinazzi has to do what Tictum's doing. He has to push and beat Sete Câmara quickly, otherwise his stock is going to plummet. That's just the reality of racing at this level.
Yeah, I think you're right, Sam. And it's quite interesting with Sergio Sete Câmara, because for a team looking at drivers for the future, as every team does, you look at him and say, well, look, there's something there, but he has too many crashes. There's too many times he's in the wall. And then the question is, well, is it because the machinery is not up to it, so he's overdriving? If that's the case, can he then come back to just below the limit when he's given better machinery? And that's a big question mark, because you don't know the answer to that. But if you look at the number of incidents that Sergio's had, there are too many. But in defence, he hasn't got the equipment. How do you judge a driver like that? Very, very difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. Jim, we haven't really spoke in depth about your team from this weekend. Jake Dennis, unbelievable pace, but ultimately unrewarded. It must be both a shame and very frustrating for the team to see all of that pace go unrewarded like that.
Oh, massively frustrating. I mean, to run second in both races and to come away with 0 points from a doubleheader is really massively frustrating. I think if you look at the three, well, the four races we've had so far, were two in Daria, one in Mexico, and the two in Rome. It's been very up and down for the team. Qualifying pace was not bad in Daria, but not ultimately quick enough. Qualifying pace in Rome was superb, and in between in Mexico, couldn't get the car a handle on the car at all. And I think probably what we've seen is that the car is now hooked up in qualifying, but it hasn't got a race set up yet, which is good enough to maintain that pace, the qualifying pace, and consume the amount of energy that we need to consume. It's over-consuming. So it's difficult. The engineers are all working hard at it. There'll be more and more simulator sessions to try and find that balance. But, you know, there is a lot of hope there. I mean, that lap, what was it, a 37.9?
Yep.
137.9 for Jake in the semi-final was a stonking lap. And yet it looked totally under control. It was a really, really good lap.
I'm just looking at my notes here from that, Jim, and I was listening to Jake's radio, and he came on, and he was, you know, he wasn't initially cock-a-hoop. He said that I think he locked up at turn 16 and thought he'd smoked it. You know, he thought he'd lost a lot of time there, but didn't. Yeah. So it actually could have been, you know, I don't know by how much, but, you know, even if it had shaved a couple of thousandths or hundredths off, it would be, you know, it would have been exceptional. I mean, perfect lap. But I was super impressed by him and continue to be so. Really unfortunate that he didn't get a result from the weekend, because he absolutely deserved it.
He did deserve it. I mean, if it was a criticism, I would say in race two on Sunday, I think he got himself in a position where he could be bullied. And I think if he was running back through the videotape and doing it again, he probably positioned his car slightly differently if given the chance again. So he wasn't in a position to be bullied.
But he punched back, didn't he? I mean, I think he's been guilty of that last season in a few races. But he punched, you know, when you go wheel to wheel with the likes of Lotterer and Degrassi, you have to, you know, you can't be bullied.
Correct.
And I think he maybe there was a slight overcompensation at times that he went, you know, he went a little bit too far the other way. But at the same time, you know, where do you draw the line on these things? Because Lotterer and Degrassi, as the evidence suggests, you know, they don't back out, and they will use every tactic known to anyone to get what they want, and often it goes over the line.
I would add to that, imagine his frustration in the car.
Yeah.
You know, having done the fastest lap of anyone over the Rome weekend, to then have a car which wasn't as good underneath him in race trim must be enormously frustrating. Can we touch a little bit on that time? Do we have a comparison in like-for-like weather conditions on that Rome circuit to gauge the progress that the teams and the drivers have made in the last couple of years of Generation 2?
Sam, do you want to go off and do some Googling while Jim and I talk?
You've just given me an idea for a feature. I'm not sure I can do it within the confines of this podcast, Jim. But
we can always edit the gap out if you want. I can. All of this can just be cut out if you need 2 minutes.
But you get my point.
Yeah.
My sense is that we are going appreciably faster. And it's the same hardware, it's exactly the same chassis, it's the same tyres, it's the same lump of energy in the battery. And yet the times are getting, you know, just more impressive times. We're also doing longer races because we're getting this additional time. It's very, very impressive.
Mm. Of course, the circuit changed, didn't it, last season.
But we've had 2 years now on that configuration of circuit, haven't we?
Yeah, last year was obviously affected by weather.
What was the first year of the new one?
It was last season, but of course the weather was inclement, was changeable. But I think if I remember rightly, in the qualifying format, and I'm being ultra dexterous here with my index finger as we're talking, if you put me under enormous pressure here, Jim. But, you know, pole position for the first race, which I think was the driest point of that weekend. Somebody will probably correct me with more forensic knowledge of it. But, you know, Oliver Rowland set pole at 138.4, and that was in qualifying group two.
Right.
So yeah, obviously you've got to factor in as well the fact that it was a very different qualifying format. But yeah, I mean, you know, you're talking half a second there, aren't you?
Yeah, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, definitely.
Well done, Sam. You can go back to more familiar territory now with your news and calendar update. We saw Maserati officially launch its entry for season 9 ahead of the race. And depending on when we get this podcast out, you're either just about to write or have just written about another new team that's entering the championship.
Yeah, so the latest news first. I think there's a very good chance from speaking to various people last weekend in Rome that we will see the return of Apt for season 9, the first season of Gen 3. I think their plans are forming at a pace, and there seems to be some real optimism that they will be back on the grid next season. We're not exactly sure on the details of how they'll be powered, but I think when you deduct where the manufacturers are and the deals that have been done already, that it's likely to be either Mahindra or Neo Power for them next season, with the favourite being Mahindra. Thomas Biermeier, the CEO of the company, was in evidence at Rome, and I got a chance to speak to him. Mainly off the record, but we do have a piece already out there now this week, which details some of what we think will be happening there. They were quite close last year to continuing in the championship for this last season of Gen 2, which we uncovered at Monaco last year with the what was then agreed to be a partnership with the Segi TV company, a streaming media service based in the States. But that faltered at the last and didn't happen, which left Apt high and dry. So they've sat out this season. But yeah, I mean, I think they are determined to be there. And I think that things are coming together and there's a very good chance. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not done until it's done. But the expectation is that the Apt will return to the championship. Drivers wise, I think, you know, the names you would expect, Robin Freins, René Rast, Nico Müller will all be in the mix should this come off. So it will be a very, very strong proposition. So it'd be great should that all happen. But like I said, the indications in recent weeks are that the momentum is gathering and things are falling into place, and it looks good for their return. Maserati announced that they will essentially take over the Venturi team, the Venturi name, for which Jim worked for several years, will disappear from Formula E, and it will become a Maserati Formula E team run from Monaco, continues to be run from those premises. And there was Davide Grasso, the Maserati chief, and the Stellantis motorsport boss, Jean-Marc Fina, were in evidence at Rome as well, and Carlos Tavares, who I was fortunate enough to spend some time with and pick his brains about Formula E and what it means to Stellantis and doubling their entry into the championship, which again you can read on the site towards the end of the current week, was very interesting indeed. So yeah, these stories are coming now, and I think in the bigger picture of Formula E, I'm feeling, and I'm sure Jim is feeling, that there is a rise to go towards the kind of peaks we saw in 2018, 2019, where multiple manufacturers are getting more interested. We know that McLaren are close to coming into the championship, yet to be absolutely done, but I believe that is a sort of a kind of due diligence things are going on there. So that allied to Maserati and potentially Apt coming back, and hugely important figures such as Carlos Tavares are saying about Formula E, that is a major cocktail of optimism and feel-good factor. So that is that I think is putting Formula E in a much better place than it was 12 to 18 months ago.
Is that the case, Jim? Is Formula E about to boom again?
Yeah, I think so. I think we saw in season 5 a very, very steep curve, upward curve. It faltered through the pandemic, largely through no fault of Formula E's or anybody's. I also think that the qualifying format was a major own goal, which upset some of the manufacturers who were investing a lot of money and couldn't guarantee success by going through their normal process of motorsport process. So, Yeah, that put Formula E on the back foot. But yeah, the swing is upward again. Maserati announcement was great news. If, as we all hope, McLaren come in, that will also be great news. But I think we should not think that we desperately need more manufacturers into the Formula. But I do think we need good teams. And you know, the Apt team has proved previously that they were good in conjunction with Audi. Can they be good on their own with someone else's powertrain? Time will tell. And being good is not just about management and technically how good they are. Can they find the money? You know, finding the money, even with cost cap, is not easy. And if you haven't got the money, then you won't be able to choose the drivers you want. And your simulation and other areas, which are performance deciders, will become more of an issue. And you know, that's the challenge: finding the money, putting together a strong team, and then running it efficiently. And to back that up, I just point to the performances of the Venturi and Envision teams. You know, are not manufacturer teams running right at the front consistently, winning races. Very, very strong.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think both of those, but Envision in particular, you know, their ability to punch above their weight is really superb. And, you know, great to see Frines properly mixing it out the front there.
Yeah, and adding a little bit of maturity to the raw pace we've always known he's had. He looks much more composed and mature these days.
Do you know what he said to me in Rome? He said, I was asking him about the track and preparation. He just, you know what he's like. He's such a great character. He just sort of nonchalantly went, "Sam, I'm not a sim driver. I'm a race driver. I race. I don't even want to go in the sim." It's just a sort of really good laconic sort of expression of what he's all about, which is, you know, hanging it out there. And yeah, he's having a great season, and he's definitely going to be in the mix towards the end of the year, I think.
And he'll be turning up in Monaco with a leather helmet and goggles.
That'd be great. Well, speaking of Monaco, before I let you both go, I'm going to have to ask for your predictions for the race and put you on the spot. But I'll go first just up. I think the guy who's managed to win a race in every season so far will have his time, and it's going to be a Sam Bird win.
Bold, very bold. But yeah, I mean, you know, he's going to have to do it the hard way, isn't he, with three-place grid drop.
I think that'll give him the inspiration he needs, you know.
Could do.
So only three places, it's not a lot.
Could do. I think it's going to be another mega race, and I think a lot of the guys who were in that top bunch last season will be there again. DaCosta's got a point to prove. Verne is in great form. I think Mercedes, although it's not the strongest circuit, you know, De Vries would have been there or thereabouts last year if he hadn't have knocked off the power mode or gone into a different power mode in qualifying. So he's going to be around thereabouts. But I'm just going to go back to the Dutchman, the other Dutchman, Robin Frijns. I think his flair and his form, and that extra bit of maturity, as Jim described it as, I think Robin Frijns will break this barren spell that he's been on. He's not won a race since New York in 2019, would you believe, nearly 3 years ago, which is astounding. So I'm going to go for Robin to win in Monaco, and he'll celebrate it with a little kip on the pit wall. Favorite spot, I would think, afterwards.
Well, I've got to go for Jake Dennis. I think the form he's in qualifying, we'll see him put it on pole. And if you're at pole in Monaco, you can win a race, even in Formula E. So I'm going for Jake. It's his type of circuit. He's going to rise to the occasion. Nailed on. Avalanche Andretti. There we go.
Well, we heard it here first. Well, thank you both for that. Jim, best of luck for Monaco, and hopefully the bookie will take your bet despite your insider knowledge. And for the rest of the season, Sam, enjoy the weekend away from any racing. If there is any news, we'll have it all up on therace.com. Don't forget the hyphen. And please check out our other podcasts on Formula One, IndyCar and MotoGP. And if you like some video content, then check out The Race on YouTube. So thank you all very much, and goodbye.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF-IN-IOWA. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.